On the program today, XOM, AMZN, and the DJIA. Think for a minute. You'll get it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 26th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is a corporate news kind of day. Some days you get economic indicators to start the program. Some days you get market news. Today, we got companies, big companies too. So let us just tick through the list here, shall we? Energy leads the way. Kind of surprising news out of ExxonMobil's annual shareholder meeting today. Ticker symbol XOM, by the way. Turns out a hedge fund, a relatively small-ish hedge fund called Engine Number One, which holds a very small slice of ExxonMobil's stock, has convinced some other much bigger shareholders that they should put a couple of Engine Number One's candidates on that company's board of directors. Candidates that would, and this is the important part, force Exxon to cut back on its fossil fuel strategy and investments and do more about climate change. It sounds insidery, I suppose, a little bit of corporate governance, but it is a very big deal. Also, and related, a court over in the Netherlands today ordered Royal Dutch Shell to cut its carbon emissions by 45% within the next 9 years, which is basically like tomorrow in corporate time. All right, moving on. Big Wall Street bank CEOs were on Capitol Hill today, virtually, of course, that is. It was about what you'd expect from one of those five witnesses, a dozen or more senators asking questions kind of hearings. Inflation is on their minds, it turns out. Nothing new there. Housing is in a bit of a bubble. Nothing really new there either, that kind of thing. Although, should be said, Elizabeth Warren, Senator of Massachusetts, did give J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon a good going over about overdraft fees and the $1.5 billion that J.P. Morgan collected of them in the past year. And at Amazon's annual meeting, AMZN, of course, Jeff Bezos said July 5th is going to be his last day as CEO. That was a trick headline because it is not the Amazon news of the day. After a week or two of rumors, the company said today it is going to buy MGM Studios for $8.5 billion. That's all in with debt. Yes, it is a big-ish mergers and acquisitions story, but as with so much other news of late, this is at least as much a tech story. So we have gotten Molly Wood on the phone. She is the host of Marketplace Tech when she's not busy doing my job when I'm sick. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
Well, you know, I appreciate you. I appreciate you coming in. So look.
Thanks, man.
It is a tech story, and tech and Amazon, it's got to be Amazon Prime, which is at the root of this deal, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think we would be mistaken if we said this is Amazon's attempt to beat Netflix, right? Or become Netflix. Certainly, streaming video as a business model has more than proven itself. It's been interesting for a while that Amazon has made good shows, clearly, and created its own content for its Amazon video streaming service, but hasn't tried to acquire a big library until now. And I think what this ultimately is a very expensive way to get people in the door and want to pay for that Prime subscription, which is where Amazon makes a lot of money, and also maybe pay a little bit, like we talked about on Make Me Smart, pay a little bit here and there to subscribe to other services like Showtime or Cinemax. I mean, Amazon does a tidy little business as almost a leads generator for other streaming services, too.
Right. Make Me Smart, of course, the podcast that we do together, should you be in the mood for a podcast, listeners out there. We talked about the story at the morning meeting this morning, and I think Michael Lipkin, actually, your producer, said it's about stickiness for Amazon Prime, right? They want to get people in and give them just another reason to stick around. Forget the free delivery, forget all that stuff, and maybe that $100 or so dollars a year ain't so bad if you get all these movies, too.
Exactly. And you have seen people sort of start to grumble about the price of Prime going up as it has over the couple of years. And if you only think of it as paying for free shipping, it does start to feel like, well, is this really worth it? I can get free shipping from Target. It is not about e-commerce. Prime is about the idea that once you have subscribed and you're part of this ecosystem, you get all of these different benefits. And, you know, probably, yes, there's a little bit of Hollywood dabbling here. Also, in the Amazon shareholder meeting today, Jeff Bezos, in addition to announcing his retirement date, said that they plan to use this MGM catalog and develop, you know, intellectual property, new shows around it, extend it into new entertainment.
Yeah, which is the name of the game, the IP. So you said they're not competing with Netflix, right? So Reed Hastings and Ted Sarandos aren't necessarily nervous about this deal. Bob Iger, the executive chairman of Disney, but really functioning mostly as the chief executive officer, is probably not nervous about this deal. What if you're like Peacock or Hulu?
Yeah, then I think you really have to worry. Unless you can get a great deal for placement within Amazon Prime, subscribe to Peacock or Hulu through Amazon Prime. And that is one of the ways that I think Amazon is trying to deflect some of the antitrust worries about this, is by saying, listen, we're not that big in streaming. We don't intend to be, the only name in video streaming. And look at all of the ways that we offer consumers to subscribe to our competitors through our service. As long as they keep doing that, I think they hope they can keep the antitrust boogeyman off their backs.
Yeah. Molly Wood, she of many hats in this production shop. Thanks, Molly. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Guy.
This afternoon, in fact, on the podcast. Anyway.
I'll be there.
All right, good. Me too. All right, moving on. You want to be an entrepreneur, you want to start a new business, you got to have some guts. And in no industry right now, I think you can fairly say, are more guts required than in commercial aviation. Which is why it's interesting there's a new airline taking off tomorrow, Breeze Airways. It's going to fly mostly in the south and east. Departs Tampa at 10:30 Eastern, bound for Charleston, South Carolina, if you're in the mood. Avelo Airlines started flying just last month here out west. So, marketplace with Samantha Fields has more now on the risks and potential rewards of post-pandemic aviation.
Establishing a new airline in the U.S. is not easy.
The risks are huge. The graveyard of failed startup airlines in the U.S. is large and deep.
Edward Russell covers the industry for Skift and Airline Weekly, and he says for one thing, there's intense competition.
Major airlines often come in and will add flights on routes that these startup carriers add.
That is already happening to Avelo, he says, on some of its brand new routes. Starting and running an airline also just costs a lot of money, says Savi Saith, an industry analyst at Raymond James, which is a marketplace underwriter.
Aircraft are expensive.
And so are fuel and labor. But in some ways, Saith says, coming out of a pandemic is probably one of the best possible times to launch a new leisure-focused airline.
Because of the success of the vaccines and people having been locked in for a long time, there's a lot of pent-up demand here for leisure travel.
So much pent-up demand, in fact, that a Wells Fargo economist estimates 4.5 years of travel spending could happen in the next 9 months. Breeze Airways CEO David Neeleman also says the pandemic has helped bring down at least one of its big startup costs.
We got some planes for a really good price, so that helps our costs.
The airline has also automated a lot of things, he says, and everyone answering customer questions.
They're working in their homes, and that allows you to keep your costs low.
It's the first time in a while that two new airlines are entering the market, and Véronique de Rougy at George Mason University's Mercatus Center says,
it seems like a pretty great deal for consumers. Consumers are going to have way more choice.
For cheaper flights, at least for now. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
At least for now. On Wall Street today, kind of a wash. Really, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today, in birthdays, we mark the 125th of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. That one was easy, right? DJIA. We'll give you today's reading of the blue chips, as they're known, in due course, as we always do. But first, Marketplace's Sabri Benishor is on the history desk today.
1896. Railroads ruled the U.S. economy. Industry was ascendant, and farmers, upset by mortgage rates and rail freight costs, were powering a wave of populist unrest across the country. Charles Dow sensed the upheaval in the economy, the move towards industrialization.
The idea behind the Dow is, what is happening in the market? How can we quantify it and see it? And therefore, how can we predict what to do?
Howard Silverblatt is a senior analyst with S&P Dow Jones Indices, which is a marketplace underwriter. The Dow is the second longest running index in the world, behind the Dow Railroad Index, which was created 12 years earlier. It got its name from Charles Dow and Edward Jones, founders of the Wall Street Journal. These days, it's calculated based on the stock prices of just 30 companies. Those companies are decided by a secret committee.
They select the companies from the S&P 500 and review whether or not it's representative of the U.S. economy and accurately reflects what's happening.
Because of its small sample size of major companies and its emphasis on stock prices as opposed to market capitalization, the Dow is not like the S&P 500 or the Russell 2000, for example. Tom Essay is president of Sevens Report Research.
And that can tend to let the Dow be a bit more volatile. It also can be skewed more by one stock.
But he says it gives you a glimpse of the economy that other indices don't. And the fact that companies cycle in and out means it's a flexible snapshot. Joe Bruzuelas, chief economist with RSM, says the index is also just plain popular.
The Dow Jones Industrial Averages has a special place in the imagination and reality of the American public.
It's one reason we talk about it every day. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Buy me a beer sometime, I'll tell you the other reasons we talk about it every day. Should you miss us on the air, by the by, might I remind you here, we've got a podcast. You can check that out too. Don't look now, but trade news is in the air again. The Biden administration's using the new, but kind of the same as the old, U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, USMCA to those who prefer, for the first time, and it's using it against the Canadian dairy industry. To be clear, discontent between American dairy farmers and our neighbors to the north is not new, but there had been some hope the new, but kind of the same as old, trade deal had things changing. Turns out it hasn't. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what's going on here.
Okay, we're going to try to stay out of the weeds here, but at its root, the disagreement between the U.S. and Canadian dairy industries has to do with the way each government tries to help farmers break even.
The Canadian approach is to maintain high prices by creating this quota system.
That's Christopher Sands. He's director of the Canada Institute at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He says Canada tells farmers how much product they can sell and then guarantees a price.
The U.S. does it differently. We subsidize production.
American consumers pay a tax, and that tax subsidizes farmers. Now, this new formal dispute is accusing Canada of setting aside too large a share of the dairy market exclusively for Canadian dairy processors, something Canadian-American trade lawyer Mark Werner calls a smart lawyer workaround.
Those guys don't have really any incentive to import dairy. So if you give the quota to the large processors, well, they're not going to import it.
They'll instead just process Canadian dairy and avoid any tariffs. U.S. dairy farmers say this denies them access to an important market. Krista Harden is president of the U.S. Dairy Export Council.
Canada has maintained its measures that really run counter to its market access obligations under the trade agreement, under USMCA.
Canada's Trade Minister, Mary Ng, voiced her disappointment with the U.S. requesting a dispute panel, and she says she's confident that her country's policies are in full compliance with the trade agreement. The International Trade Commission says if the USMCA were to be implemented as it was negotiated, U.S. dairy exports would go up by more than $300 million a year. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Minimizing the negative and maximizing the positive.
So, glass half full, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 10 today. Almost nothing, really, percentage-wise. 34,323. The NASDAQ gained 80 points, call it 0.6%, 13,737. The S&P 500 pocketed 7 points, almost 0.2%, 41.95. ExxonMobil, shares gained 1.1% today. Shares in Royal Dutch Shell gained 0.6% on the Amsterdam Exchange. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note, up to 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We did a thing on long-term unemployment last week, a bit of history, a quick explainer, as part of which we pointed out that there are, as of the April jobs report, something like 4.2 million people in this economy in that category, out of work 6 months or more. A lot of them are women who've been hit disproportionately, as you know. And getting them back to work is going to take a lot of pieces falling into place. Open schools, available childcare, also the right kinds of jobs. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has our story.
This starts as a love story between a woman, Marta Marecki, and her job, making booze.
It was crazy. I was a distiller. I mean, I was mashing grain and driving forklifts and filling bottles, and it was amazing, and I loved it.
She even sent me a video to kind of show off. Marecki's in work clothes. She's on a forklift hoisting enormous sacks of grain. The video's from early 2020, shortly before she was laid off. Like nearly 4 million women who were working before the pandemic, she doesn't have a job now. So let's back up.
Okay, so I'm 48 years old. I have a daughter who is 15, a son who's 13, and we live in Washington, D.C.
Marecki's husband works for the Defense Department, and when their kids were in elementary school, his job took the family to Japan.
While we lived there, I did some part-time work, same kind of thing I did in the U.S. when the kids were little. I taught cooking classes. I'm a trained chef. I worked as a personal chef.
The family returned to the U.S. in 2019. They put the kids in middle school, and Marecki got down to looking for a full-time job.
I was driving past a distillery, and I thought, hey, that's really cool. My undergraduate degree is in chemistry. I went to cooking school, and I thought, I could do distilling.
And she landed a job making rye, bourbon, gin, and vodka.
And then March 2020 came along. Restaurants and bars started closing down. The distillery took a hit, laid off 3 of its 9 full-time employees.
And she was one of them.
I'd been working 50 hours a week. It was a shock. I didn't see it coming.
She didn't qualify for unemployment because she'd worked just shy of 6 months. Eventually, she found another job making hand sanitizer, but was laid off again.
I applied for a bit to jobs and didn't go well. Sorry. So I decided to take a step back from the job search.
Then she heard about a local food bank and it needed volunteers.
So I'm doing that with my time now, 2 days a week. And it's great because these are people who need help. And I have time.
Marecki's also been helping her teenagers with their at-home schooling. For a lot of other women who lost jobs in the pandemic, caring for kids and other family members has become a full-time gig. Some women even had to leave their jobs to do it. The bottom line, the percentage of women in the workforce has fallen to its lowest level since the late 1980s.
Women at all stages of their careers, younger women who are just entering the workforce for the first time, mid-level careerist CEOs are all struggling.
C. Nicole Mason is president of the Institute for Women's Policy Research. She says the wave of women not working is alarming.
1 year out of the labor force for women at age 30 can cost nearly $110,000 over a lifetime. It has a definite impact on their career mobility. The longer you're out of the workforce, the harder it is to get back in.
It's now been 8 months since Marta Marecki got laid off. I called her recently to see how things are going, and she had some news.
We're moving to Singapore next month. My husband's work is taking us there.
So another chance, another challenge to get back into the job market.
I've got a very eclectic resume. I've done a lot of odd things. And I don't look back and think, wow, I wish I stayed in the Navy 20 years ago, or I wish I stayed in telecom. But I can't help but feel that I've kind of run out of options. People are not killing themselves to hire overeducated, underemployed 48-year-old women. They're just not.
Marecki says she is trying to stay positive, researching distilleries and food science master's programs in Singapore. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
One can safely bet that the chief sustainability officer at ExxonMobil is going to be busier from here on out, given the changes coming to that company's board of directors that we mentioned up at the top of the program. And it turns out a couple of decades into the now widespread accepted truth that the planet is getting hotter, more companies are adding another seat to the C-suite for a CSO, a chief sustainability officer. A CSO recruiting firm called the Weinreb Group crunched the numbers and found more publicly traded American companies hired their first CSO in 2020 than in the three previous years combined, and that more of those CSOs are taking on duties beyond just environmental sustainability. Ellen Weinreb is a sustainability recruiter. Also, she was in charge of that report I mentioned. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
So chief sustainability officers ain't what they used to be, right? The job has evolved since you've been doing this.
That's right. We've been recruiting in this field of sustainability for over a decade, and we did research 10 years ago. And perhaps the biggest change is the role that investors have played in encouraging corporations to be more involved in sustainability.
You say investors, and that leads me to think that maybe companies are doing this because they think they ought to instead of because they want to?
The companies are doing the right thing, and at the same time, money talks. So if right. you're a CEO and the investors are saying, what is your performance on environmental, social, and governance, ESG, the CEO listens, the board listens. And so that is a huge impetus for change.
I imagine the role of the chief sustainability officer depends on what the company does, right? It can't be, just to pick two big companies, it can't be that the chief sustainability officer at like Wells Fargo does the same thing day in and day out that the CSO at I don't know, like Walmart does.
Well, at the end of the day, a chief sustainability officer is minimizing the negative and maximizing the positive impacts on society and the planet. And it's very industry dependent, yeah. yet at the same time, it's all towards a social and environmental good.
Yeah, makes sense. Is it tricky just on the recruiting part of your job? Is it tricky to find people to fill these jobs? I mean, it is, you know, climate change isn't new, but this field as an area of expertise kind of is.
Well, the field of sustainability is relatively new compared to traditional functions. 10 years ago, the sustainability officers didn't have a lot of previous experience in sustainability, and now they do. So, and yeah, the searches are hard and challenging, you know, between racial justice and the pandemic and just more volatility in the world. It's a challenging job.
What are the metrics? I mean, when you go out and look for some, you know, Fortune 500 chief sustainability officer, what are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for previous experience, and it's largely about influencing change and having the ability to translate what's going on externally to how that benefits and supports the company.
So let me ask you the bigger picture question, right? And that's, you know, no matter what happens with the chief sustainability officer, am I right in saying that ESG, all three of those elements, are now becoming almost mandatory in corporate America?
Yeah, definitely. You've got the role of sustainability officer and the head role of sustainability is no longer a might have. It's now a must have.
Yeah. Ellen Weinreb, her company is called the Weinreb Group. Ellen, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Final note on the way out, inadvertently, I guess, making sustainability the theme of the program with ExxonMobil and Ellen Weinreb just now. Ford said today it's going to increase its spending on electric vehicles to $30 billion by 2025, and more to the point, that 40% of its global sales are going to be fully electric by 2030, which is great, but is like really soon.
Marketplace is supported by Hint, fruit-infused water in over 25 flavors, no sweeteners, no calories, in stores or delivered from drinkhint.com. Hint, water with a touch of true fruit flavor. And by Fidelity Wealth Management, helping clients develop a personalized plan to help grow and protect their wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Mimecast, used by nearly 40,000 organizations to help keep them safe from phishing, business email compromise, and ransomware. Learn more at Mimecast.com.
All right, we got to go. Here's your moment of economic context, your occasional reminder that incentives matter. Remember a couple of weeks ago, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine announced a lottery program, $1 million, to the lucky vaccinated winner of a special weekly drawing for $1 million. I'm going to say this again, $1 million. Anyway, the first winner will be announced tonight. Good luck, of course, to all of those who entered. The incentives part here? The state says the weekend after DeWine made the announcement of the lottery program, there was a 28% increase in vaccinations. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Siebold, Liana Squalace, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torado, and Becca Weinman. They're coming in, so the rest of us don't have to. You know the drill. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.